You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
So I decided that instead of trying to avoid typecasting, I was going to be flagrantly female.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Anna Quinlan says all writers are influenced by their experiences, whether they like it or not.
Is it possible for me to write about loss or marriage or love without using what I've learned about those things in my real life? No. But what happens is it becomes like sausage. Everything that you've done in your life gets ground up into a form that has nothing to do with your own life.
Anna Quinlan is a New York Times columnist and a prolific author of novels and nonfiction books. Her book, One True Thing, was made into a movie starring Meryl Streep. Quinlan's latest novel is Alternate Side, about a New York City family whose idyllic life is shaken by a violent act on their quiet cul-de-sac. She talks this hour with Cynthia Canty, host of the Michigan radio program Stateside. Cynthia asked what Anna wanted to be before she decided to become a writer.
An archaeologist.
Yes. Why?
I don't know. It sounded exotic and interesting and hyper-intellectual and different than what anybody else I knew did, especially women.
And it's a fascinating field. I was lucky enough to take a year in archaeology when I was going to school in Cork, and I actually studied under the professor who excavated the Newgrange tombs north of Dublin. And it is, and the link to the past is just, it's amazing. So what turned you to writing and when?
It's really, really simple. And I say it over and over again because I think it's really important to say it. I am a writer because of teachers.
Teachers!
Absolutely.
How so?
I had a certain, I think, natural facility for working with words in a particular kind of voice. I never really felt the way so many people seem to feel, and certainly the way so many young people seem to feel, that I had to come up with some phony alternate voice other than my own. And over again, teachers would say to me, "You're really good at this. You should keep doing this. A. And I mean, except for your parents, when you're growing up, teachers are the most influential, important people in your lives. And to have them do that made all the difference in the world to me.
And it sounds like it started early.
Really early. I mean, and a nice contrast to the rest of what was going on with me, it may come as a surprise to you to hear that I was not the most tractable and obedient little girl in the classroom.
You were feisty.
And so there was this idea that you know, conduct, not so good. English, excellent. And you know, I think you just keep doing the things that you're rewarded for.
And then at what point did you start thinking, I could make a living doing this?
Well, I really wanted to be a novelist. I love to read. I don't love to write, but I love to read and have ever since I can remember. I mean, I really feel like I've experienced the world through the books I've read. And when I was 11, I went to our local library to see where my book would be shelved. It was between Proust and Ayn Rand. The problem was, as I got a little older, I thought, how in the world do you make a living as a novelist? You know, there's no novelist firm where you go to work every day and at the end of the week they give you a paycheck. And that's how I wound up going into the newspaper business. I was the editor of my high school newspaper. We won a number of awards from local dailies. I persuaded one of them to give me a job as a copy girl. I intended to work in newspapers just long enough to make the money to become a novelist. And then I discovered that being a street reporter on a daily newspaper is about the best job on the face of God's green earth.
Why?
Because you get to go play. First of all, okay, I'm a Catholic schoolgirl. So, this is my operative pose,
right? We do what we're told.
All of a sudden, I'm supposed to go places where people don't want me to go and ask questions they don't want to answer. It was like I'd died and gone to heaven. It was so contrary to everything my grandmother had taught me. And also, I think even really early days, I apprehended that understanding the lives of people who were quite different than I was and who hadn't gotten so many of the breaks that I had would make me a better human being. And it did. Being a reporter made me a better person.
Now, I still remember my first radio broadcast at 2 in the morning in December 1979 at WMUZ in Detroit. And I remember it vividly. Blind terror and, afraid you're going to fall
on
your face.
I know,
but it's
so
thrilling. But it was thrilling at the same time. Do you remember your first story?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me.
I do. It ran on page one of the Sunday New Brunswick, New Jersey Home News. In the summer of 1970, it was about a man named Herbert Randall who had turned 100 years old. And I think the lead was something like, a person who gives up smoking nowadays is not so unusual, but for Herbert Randall, it is out of the ordinary. And then it went on to talk about him turning 100. And obviously, I remember writing this story and having it, knowing that it was going to appear in the paper. But here's what I remember best. My father went out to get the Sunday paper, as he did every Sunday morning, and he came back in with a stack of about 8 of them, so tall that you couldn't even see his face. And I thought, this makes my father happy.
And proud.
Yes.
And proud.
Yes.
As you think of those years, street reporting, and I can put my finger on ones that still burn in my heart, the ones that just rip you apart, but you have to put your game face on, and put your emotions, stuff it back in the back of the news truck or wherever you're at, because you can't let your emotions get in the way. Do you remember any stories like that you can still, that really just hit you hard and stayed in your heart?
Well, a lot of them, because I was hired at the Times when I was 24 years old. I was a tabloid reporter, and for a couple of months I convinced myself that I'd been hired at that age from that background because I was the smartest little girl in America. And I wasn't too far into my time at the Times when I realized that I'd actually been hired because 6 unbelievably courageous women had brought a class action suit against the paper, charging that it didn't hire, pay, or promote women in parity with men.
Funny thing, where have we heard that? Here we are.
And as part of the settlement, the Times suddenly had to go out and hire a whole lot of women. All at once. And so I got hired, and there was a perception that I was a feature writer, a dab hand with a metaphor and a simile. But I was also intensely interested in the poor, the disenfranchised, women who were struggling in New York City. And so over and over again, I wrote stories where I would go to the apartment of somebody who was doing her level best to raise 3 little kids with no money, no child care, a welfare system. you gotta love this country. We demonize prosperous women who go back to work after they have their children, and we demonize poor women who won't go back to work after they have their children.
Yeah.
And you know what? They would love to go back to work, except that we're the only developed country that doesn't have a national child care system.
Thank you. That's so true.
So I kept going out on these stories, and each time, God, walking away was the hardest thing. I wanted to give people money. I wanted to make calls to help them out. I wanted to get them jobs. And making that distinction between writing the story and changing the story, it was a constant challenge not to try to intervene in the lives of the people I was writing about.
Be an advocate for them.
Yeah, exactly.
And then is that how you started percolating ideas for stories, in a sense? Because you can give voice to these people through your stories.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't care. I never wanted to cover the White House. I didn't care about, going abroad. I couldn't do that anyhow because my husband is an attorney whose work is very grounded in the United States. I wanted to be a street reporter covering the lives mm-hmm. of people whose lives weren't often covered. I mean, I was really motivated by that H.L. Mencken quote about afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted.
When did the idea for your first novel, Object Lessons, when did that start percolating in your head? And how long did it take for you to take the plunge and go, all right, I'm going to write this?
That sense of what I wanted to write about?
Yep, and that you were at the point where you were going to write that first novel.
Oh, the novel.
The novel, yeah.
Well, I always wanted to do that, mm-hmm. and I was looking for the opportunity.
Right.
But, first I was a street reporter, mm-hmm. and...
And that's demanding
and
draining.
It's really demanding, and I would get home at night, and I had no will to do any more writing. And then I wrote a column called About New York, which again was demanding because mm-hmm. I had to generate two columns a week. And then I was deputy metro editor, and then in 2 years, I had two little boys back to back. I went in the second time and said to the executive editor, I'm pregnant, and he said, you did that last year.
And
oddly enough, I was deputy metro editor when I had Quinn, and I went on a 6-month maternity leave, and immediately I got pregnant with Christopher again. Someone said, well, she is Catholic. And I said, if I were Catholic the way you meant that, I'd have 9 children by now. But at the end of that pregnancy, I actually quit my job at the Times because I just didn't feel like I could. I felt like I was going to miss a lot of good stuff at home. And it was when I was about 3 or 4 months in after Christopher was born that I thought I can start working on a novel. And I started working on a novel then, and about 6 months in, I was offered the opportunity to create a weekly column in the New York Times called Life in the 30s, which basically was created just to sort of keep my hand in, and we didn't think anybody was going to read it, and then
and they did.
People read it.
And they read it. And they read
so
it.
So I wrote Object Lessons while I was doing Life in the 30s, and then we published it then, and I started One True Thing then and finished it when I became an op-ed page columnist.
That's a lot of spinning plates.
Yeah, it was.
A lot of spinning plates.
It was a lot of spinning plates.
Absolutely. What did and do, what does writing novels allow you to do that you couldn't do when you were pounding the street and reporting stories?
Well, there's two things. One is obvious. It's a much larger canvas. So that instead, it's usually about 80,000-85,000 words, whereas my columns were each about 800 words, and so were a lot of my, general assignment mm-hmm. stories. So it's a bigger canvas that can tell you more about the human condition. But the other thing is you can, perfected is the wrong word, but what you know when you're out reporting mm-hmm. a story is somewhere there is someone who would be absolutely emblematic of everything that you're trying to say in the story. And every once in a while, you start to interview somebody, and they are that person. And it's like,
bells
the top of your head, yeah, you're so excited about this.
Yeah.
But most of the time, that doesn't happen. So you have to work with what you have. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a novel, the emblematic character can always be there, because you're creating that person from the ground up. And those two things together give me an opportunity to say something broader and more global about the human condition than sometimes I was able to say in newspaper stories or columns.
And speaking of saying something, having your voice expressing your views and opinions, as a street reporter, when I was a TV reporter, and even what I do now, you're neutral. You're the conduit for your readers, conduit for your listeners or your viewers to the story. And opinion, my opinion and your opinion when you were reporting, that didn't enter into it. Was it hard to make that jump to say, I'm putting my voice out there. I don't care if they like it or not. My voice and my view. To get out of the habit of being the impartial, neutral person.
Well, I'd done that as a columnist, but
you started with the column, though, was that hard?
I had the best preparation for being an op-ed page columnist, I think, in history, which is, first I had one column about New York. It's not an opinion column. Mm-hmm. It's a reporting column.
Right.
You go out and find any weird, quirky little story in the city of New York, and you write it in an idiosyncratic style. So from that, I learn how to generate two columns a week and how to come up with ideas that are somewhat off the beaten path. Then I go on to write Life in the 30s, and for the first time, I'm using the first person singular. So that teaches me to put myself out there and to create a persona. The difference between columnists who really adhere to the public's sensibility and ones who don't is that there's a kind of a persona that you say to yourself, that Gail Collins, I really know her. She's a funny woman, but she's smarter. Mm-hmm. You know, all over the map. So in Life in the 30s, I had to develop a persona, and I had to become comfortable with being somewhat revelatory. So I pull those two things together, and when I finally get on the op-ed page,
you were ready.
I know how to do it. I'm ready. The thing that was challenging was I was the third woman to become a columnist on the Times op-ed page. My two predecessors, Flora Lewis and Anne O'Hare McCormick, both covered foreign affairs at a very different time than the time that I was writing in. And if you'd taken their bylines off their columns, there would have been nothing to tell you that they were female, nor did there need to be anything to tell you that they were female. But I got that column in 1990, and I was the only woman on the page. And I was told often that I shouldn't typecast myself as a female columnist. And over time, I began to think that I had a moral responsibility to carry the flag for the issues that were most important to women in America, whether it was reproductive rights or raising small kids or taking care of the poorest among us or schools and literacy. So I decided that instead of trying to avoid typecasting, I was going to be flagrantly female. And that's what I did.
And I think all of that paid off in then some. And here we are tonight talking about your ninth novel, Alternate Side. And we do promise everybody spoiler-free discussions here because we want you to discover the story for yourselves. But I know you've said, I read an interview with you, you said, I always begin my novel with a theme. So tell us, what was your theme that jumped you into Alternate Side?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of times you start with a theme, and then as the novel progresses, you realize that either that isn't the theme of the book or it's one of many themes. The genesis of this book is that my eldest son was reading Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities a couple of years ago, which is a very fine, resonant, and memorable novel, but has been around for a while now. And it occurred to me that there might be something new to say about class and race in America, particularly as encapsulated in the city of New York. It also occurred to me that the Wolfe book is told from quite a male perspective, and that it might benefit from being told from a female perspective. And that was kind of the impulse that I started out with, a book about the divisions of class and race in the big city. And I was a little surprised to discover about halfway in that what I was really writing was a novel about marriage. That's not all it's about.
No.
And it's one of the interesting things to me about this novel is more than any other novel I've written, it's very clear to me that it's like The Blind Men and the Elephant. Some people have described it as warm and compassionate. Some people have described it as dark and dangerous. Some people have described it as witty. Some people have described it as sarcastic and pointed. And the response to it seems to have a whole lot to do with what the reader brings to the table. And certainly, part of that is because I talked about the columnist persona before. The persona that developed around me when I was a columnist and inevitably to some extent follows me during my life as a novelist is kind of a best friend persona, a warm, approachable.
Experiencing our lives.
Yeah, this book is harsher than that. This book is much harsher than that. And I think some people who have a feeling about a certain kind of Anna are taken aback by the person that they discover within the pages of this book.
Are you cool with that? You're comfortable with that?
Not only am I comfortable with that, I'm kind of radical about it in that I really love this book. I did exactly what I wanted to do. And I think all of my novels have in some way had slightly different colors. I try to challenge myself in each one. Still Life with Breadcrumbs is very different from every last one. Miller's Valley is very different from Still Life with Breadcrumbs. And I see that as part of this continuum. But I think on the one hand, there were readers who found me a little bit too domestic, who are kind of thrilled by the edge of this book. And then there are ones who were comfortable with that, who are a little taken aback by it.
And the story centers around Nora Nolan and her husband, Charlie. Tell us just a little about them, how long they're married and what they do.
Sure, Nora and Charlie live in New York City. They have been married for 25 years. They have twins, Rachel and Oliver. And they have that kind of marriage that often people have after a long marriage. They're comfortable with each other, which sometimes, if not often, translates into taking each other for granted. There's a moment where Nora thinks to herself that part of being married is having things settled. You know, you don't have to date anymore, you don't have to wear mascara all the time, you can wear a ratty nightgown, but what it also sometimes means is that you feel foolish leaning in 10 or 15 years in and saying, by the way, are you happy? Do you like this life? That marriage can take on a kind of institutional inertia. And this book centers around a moment when that inertia is shaken by an act of violence that takes place on their very insular block, to which the two of them respond in radically different ways.
And speaking of that insular block, they live on a cul-de-sac street, and I'm gathering, is that kind of rare in New York City? Because we all have this image of high rises, and they're in homes in this cul-de-sac.
There are very few dead-end blocks in Manhattan.
So what did that kind of dead-end block setting let you do with the story and the characters? What's that metaphor?
Oh, it lets you create a bell jar, which I tend to do in all of my novels when I look back on them. I mean, the town, that Mimi Miller lives in Miller's Valley is very much a bell jar. The little place where Rebecca Winter finds herself in Still Life with Breadcrumbs. I like to have a setting that I can get my hands around. Now, obviously, I'm writing about New York City, which is a place that's very tough to get your hands around, except that the truth is that New York is deeply, deeply tribal. That New Yorkers have neighborhoods which are as small as any small town in America. So you'll say to somebody, you know, oh, do you shop at such and such? And they say, it's not really in my neighborhood. And what that means is instead of 8 blocks away, it's 12 blocks away. And of course, you know, you could go there at any time, but you get used to this kind of little square in which you operate. And that seemed to me the way that I could get my hands around not only Nora, but the people who are important in her life.
I thought of it as a petri dish, too. Maybe it was that pre-med background. And then there's such an important and evolving storyline in this book about parking. Now, I've lived in Michigan my whole life outside the suburbs of Detroit, so I never gave parking a second thought. You pull in the driveway, you pull in the garage, park in front of your house. For New Yorkers, it is like the ultimate big game hunting quest. So why did you spend so much time on parking, that sense of tension and competition?
Well, first of all, because one of the things this book is about is aging. Mm-hmm. And the difference in which men and women approach middle age. I think women handle aging much better in general than their male counterparts do. In part because our lives have been a constant process of change, most of us, in ways that is not necessarily true for our male counterparts. In part because we spent our whole lives gauging what people think of us and how they feel about us. And then we hit a juncture, which in my life was at about 50, where I woke up one day and said, I do not give a damn what anyone thinks about me.
Oh, and I'm jealous.
It was so liberating. liberating.
Bottle that.
and of course, our male counterparts haven't lived with that mm-hmm. sense of what other people think about them in the same way. And so that's not a liberating moment for them. In fact, it's an enervating moment when they realize that this may be as far as they're gonna go at work, mm-hmm. that they're, not to put too fine a point on it, that their glory years of potency may be coming to an end.
On many levels.
You know, I mean, look, I have friends who have had incredible accomplishments in the world. And one of their inner dialogues is always, I cannot believe it. I cannot believe I have this job. I cannot believe I got to this point because of the way we were socialized as girls. I think many more of our male counterparts get to a certain point and think, I can't believe I didn't get the big job. I can't believe I'm not a master of the universe. And the parking really, and the parking lot where these guys park, is in some ways an extended metaphor for them feeling like they need a piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. And when the piece of the pie is interfered with, they go postal in a way that makes no sense.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Anna Quindlen talks more about her latest novel, Alternate Side.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Cynthia Canty's conversation with Anna Quindlen.
The way you drew the inner voices of Nora and the nuances of her marriage with Charlie, it was so believable of, you know, that feeling of a long-time marriage, and I hear this from so many people who love your work, how did she know what I was thinking? And make it so true, and it's out of your imagination, but yet it strikes chords into with your readers where you just feel like it's part of your life. So I'm wondering, can you take us into your process for creating and developing characters like Nora and Charlie? How do you do it?
I can, but I have to start with a caveat.
Okay.
A number of years ago, I was at a book party, and I was talking to Edgar Doctorow, known to his readers, of course, as E.L. Doctorow, one of the finest novelists of the 20th century. And I say this not to drop a name, but to show that I was talking to somebody who really knows what he's talking about. And he said, "So what's up, Anna?" And I said, "Well, I'm getting ready to go on book tour." And he sighed and said, "Oh, poor you. You'll have to go out there and pretend we know how we do what we do."
Oh, I love that.
And I was so thrilled because, like so many other things, and I'm trying not to think of this as particularly a woman thing, although I do, when I hit bumps in the road or when I have what I think are idiosyncratic moments, I think it's just me. Mm. I mean, the great glory of reading is that it teaches you that nothing is just you. It makes us all feel less alone and more connected, which is more important right now than ever before in my lifetime.
Please, yes.
I will just add one thing to that. Beware the man who does not read, because he does not know. Anyhow, I think what Doctorow was saying, and what it was so thrilling for me to hear from such a master, is that there's something deeply unconscious about what we do when we write novels. That people will say to us, "How did you choose the name Nora?" I don't remember choosing the name Nora. I just knew that at a certain point, I knew a woman named Nora Nolan. How did you decide?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like you've decided anything. What does happen in terms of the process is when I'm about three quarters of the way through a novel, when I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, I start to think about the next one. And thinking about the next one is an enormous part of the process. I tend to either run, walk, or run and then walk alternated for about an hour and 15 minutes every morning. And during that time, I do a lot of work. And what happens is that I start to think, I really want to write about a woman living and working in New York. And then 2 days later, I think she's been married for a long time and she has two kids in college. And then a couple days after that, I think she has a sister. And 2 weeks, and each of those things builds on the other. So I know something about someone who has a younger sister that's different than when I'm writing about someone who's an only child or who is the youngest and has two older brothers. So each of those things builds more of the characters. There's more bricks in the wall. And after about 5 or 6 months, during which time I finished the novel I'm working on and I've begun the revisions and finally broken the backs of them and handed the final manuscript in, it gets to the point where I know so much about this protagonist, who's almost always female, that I start to know stuff about her friends, her husband, her children, and I'm going to say this, but I think it makes me sound totally nutty. They start to talk to each other. Things start to happen. They start to have conversations. And that's the moment at which I have to sit down and start writing.
Because it's been percolating.
Yeah, and also because I'm going to lose it. I'm going to, if I don't, so that by the, when I finally sit down and write the first chapter, it's usually pretty fast because I've been thinking about it for 5 or 6 months. It's kind of there. It's fast and it's relatively easy, which is fantastic because nothing is easy after that.
And you said earlier, you don't like the writing.
I don't like to write.
Why?
Because writing is not an exercise in putting words on the page. Writing is an exercise in confidence. Writing means sitting in front of a computer every day and saying, I have something distinctive to say and people should listen to me. And I think that's difficult for anybody. But again, I hate to whack away at this, but at least for a woman who grew up and was socialized at the time I was, the idea that you stand up on your hind legs and say, you should listen to me. I mean, I remember during the Anita Hill hearings, it's the only time I wrote five columns in a row on the same thing because I tend to like a change-up pitch. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the second column I sat down and the first sentence was, listen to me. And I just thought, yes, you should listen to me. But that's hard every day. It's hard to sit down and do it. It's hard not to have all the chatter in your head that's saying, well, this isn't very interesting. Well, this isn't very well written. Well, nobody's going to be interested in this. Well, this isn't as good as your last one. It's why I don't read reviews, because then there would just be more chatter, and I've got to keep it to a minimum.
So success, which you've had, doesn't turn down that voice. Does it keep you on your toes, that inner voice?
I don't know if it keeps me on my toes, and it is less powerful now than it was when I hadn't been doing this as long. I'm better at shutting it up than I was when I was working on my first or second novel. And it's also leavened by the voice of my editor. I've had the same book editor on all my books, which makes me a very lucky woman, the same book editor and the same publishing house.
Tell us a little about what that means, that trust and that relationship or rapport with your editor.
Well, no one else weighs in because I don't give my work to anybody else. I give the first draft to my agent and my editor. Mm-hmm. That's it. No, I don't belong to a writer's group. I would never let anyone I love, well, I do love my editor and my agent, but they're two of my good friends. But I would never, for example, give it to my family members.
I wondered.
For two reasons. One is I'm sure that they would be hesitant about giving me a totally honest opinion because they love me and they wouldn't want to hurt my feelings. But also, if they had any nays to say, it would lodge between my ribs in a way that might make me act on it even if they weren't right.
That's very wise.
No, but
yeah, I get that. Yeah.
You know, because people say to you about your books all the time, well, you know, if only you'd done X and Y, and the truth is that was the wrong thing to do. So Kate and I have this relationship that we've had since 1988. Mm. Two things at this point are very important. One is that she speaks fluent Quinlan at this point. And the other is that I hear her voice in my head a lot. So she sent me enough 20-page single-space memos over the years for me to be able to hear her. I'm tootling away and I hear her say, you're losing track of the story. And I think to myself, oh, shut up, Kate. This is a beautiful descriptive paragraph. Everyone will love this. They will admire my prose here. And then one of two things happens. Either I keep hearing, you're losing track of the story, you're losing track of the story, and eventually I go, oh, damn it, and I excise the paragraph. Or I keep it in, and then I get back the manuscript, and it says, you're losing track of the story here.
So she was right the first time when she was talking in your head.
So it's really, it's a relationship of great trust and mutual respect. And in part, it's a relationship in which I say, Kate, I know you want me to move this up, but I'm not going to do it. I don't think it works for the book. And she says, okay, then.
And that comes with time.
Yes.
Time and a huge network of trust.
Yes, and also what comes with time is my ability to say that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first got her edits on the first novel, which admittedly was a mess, but when I first got her edits, I felt like, I've got to do everything. She's a veteran, she knows, and little by little, I understood what I had a handle on that she was not quite as sure-handed about, and what I always needed to listen to her about.
As I read these scenes from their marriage or interactions that Nora may have with coworkers and that, I'm curious how much of your real life you harvest for your books, or do you keep up a firewall? I know when I was on the radio in Detroit, we were encouraged to talk about our lives. If anybody's from downstate, I was with Jim Harper for many years, and we would talk about our lives in the morning show. And I would ask how my daughter's Irish dance competition went, and I would be thinking, oh boy, this is when she was in 9th or 10th grade. And I would carefully answer, and I'd see my phone light up with a text. Stop talking about me! or something would happen at home, and somebody would look me in the eye and say, this better not be on the air tomorrow. Do you get that in your life, or, harvest this for your book?
No, I got it all the time when I was writing Life in the 30s. I mean, one of the single best known sentences in any of my books happens to have been not written by me, but uttered by my husband, who said, could you get up and get me a beer and not write a column about it?
John Bacon told me about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was that sense, and frankly, the best thing about Life in the 30s, my last Life in the 30s column begins with the sentence, her name is Maria, and it was written, it actually was written as a space holder 2 days before she was born, and then the space holder held. Everything I put in it turned out to be correct, which was very eerie. but at that point, neither Quinn nor Christopher could read, and that was nothing but a good thing. When I was doing the op-ed page column, if I was going to write anything about any of the three of them, I let them see it first. But all novelists are writing out of their own experience. I mean, is it possible for me to write about what it means to be a parent without somehow using the emotional tenor that I have from being a mother? No. Is it possible for me to write about loss or marriage or love without using what I've learned about those things in my real life? No. But what happens is it becomes like sausage. Everything that you've done in your life gets ground up into a form that has nothing to do with your own life. So, every single protagonist in every novel I've written, except for Blessings, I guess, people have thought was me. So, I write about this photographer who's run out of money in New York City and goes to live in the middle of nowhere and falls in love with her roofer. And everyone says to me, well, there's a lot of Anna Quinlan and Rebecca Winter, right? And I say, no, absolutely. Rebecca Winter is not like me at all. And then I write Miller's Valley about this young girl growing up in this small town that's threatened by the water authority, who want to flood it for a reservoir. And everyone says, there's a lot of Anna Quinlan and Mimi Miller. Now, Rebecca Winter and Mimi Miller have zero in common, but somehow, and people have said the same thing about Nora. Nora and I have two important things in common. One is that we both love New York City, and the other is that we both hate rats. Other than that, we're very, very different women.
Well, kudos for making her so believable. Something else that was so beautifully done in Alternate Side was exploring class and race, and particularly relevant at this point in our history, the position and the contributions of immigrants in our society. So tell us a little about Charity and Enrique or Ricky, and what you hope that your readers would take away from this.
Charity, man.
She's the bomb. She is the bomb.
Charity was their nanny when the twins were small and has morphed into their housekeeper. And she takes no prisoners.
She's the Greek chorus in their lives.
When Nora asks her if she's ever been married, she says, "Who needs that mess?" And she's from Jamaica. She has, of course, two sisters named Faith and Hope, and a brother named Perseverance. But they all call him Vance instead. And along with Enrique, or Ricky, who is the guy who is the handyman who does jobs for everyone on the block, like, you know, you need a new washer in the kitchen sink, or there's something wrong with the pipe that goes to the furnace, and who is also an immigrant. They are part of the shadow government of this block. Those people who make the lives of the more prosperous possible, which of course exists not only among people in New York City who have people they hire to take care of their kids or take care of their houses, but in this entire country. I mean, if we send immigrants home, there will be no one to care for our old people in this country. If we send immigrants home, there will be no nurses' aides. There will be nobody cleaning hotel rooms. And by the way, there will be no first-tier people working in Silicon Valley or in our hospitals as doctors. I am the granddaughter of Italian immigrants. They did not come here to speak perfect English. They did not come here to melt into the melting pot. They lived in an Italian ghetto in South Philadelphia. They came here so that their daughter could live in a more heterogeneous neighborhood. And they came here not speaking English so that their granddaughter could write for the New York Times.
There you go. I'm interested, were you still writing as our current political climate regarding immigrants was developing, or had you already written that?
I think that climate has always been there. The identity of the defiled and hated immigrants just changes. I mean, come on, I'm a daughter of Ireland. Mm-hmm. No Irish need apply. No. I'm a daughter of Italy. You know, I grew up, my mother was such a gentle soul. The only times I heard her so angry was describing how she was called WAP and Dago when she was a young girl. So the Irish become part of the melting pot and hate the Italians. The Italians become part of the melting pot and hate the Puerto Ricans, and so on and so forth. It's just that the cast of characters changes. This is what doesn't change. These are the people whose children will make America into a country we can be proud of again.
Yep. You mentioned the New York Times. Certainly the New York Times, so many other news organizations, the Washington Post, are doing the kind of journalistic digging these days that I dare say we haven't seen since Watergate.
It's so great, isn't it? I mean, look.
Wow.
There's very little good I can... No, that's not true. Cecile Richards, who's the president of Planned Parenthood, and I am currently chairing the search committee looking for someone to succeed her, a big job, at Planned Parenthood. Cecile said not long ago to a group of our supporters, it's true, in the words of Charles Dickens, it is the best of times and the worst of times.
Yes.
And the truth of the matter is, when I look at the Women's March, the first Women's March and the second Women's March and the hundreds of thousands of people around this country, and when I look at those teenagers in Florida and what they made happen.
Yesterday.
Then I say, it's the best of times. And when I look at how the New York Times is stepping up and the Washington Post has become a first-tier newspaper again, it's just thrilling to me, the kind of drilling down, the kind of, you know, not backing off, and all the online outlets that now provide so much terrific coverage. You know, I say that's the best of times. We all know what the worst of times is.
Well, they're under attack daily.
Right.
And one has to wonder how long before that spills over into something horrible happening to someone in the press. I mean, anybody who was on the campaign trail were surrounded and threatened. Katie Tour writes about that in her book. And you just wonder, where is this going to go?
That's not my primary worry at this point. My primary worry has been the same from the morning after election night, and that is I want to live. I want my grandson to grow up in a country at peace. And I am afraid of the kind of person who has the kind of personality that suggests that war would make him as happy as a clam.
Mm-hmm. I agree. When you think of newspapers, the business of newspapers, they're under siege. We just saw the painful round of layoffs at the Denver Post and the Chicago Tribune, and your old Newsweek magazine is having a very hard time. What kind of future do you see for these young people, the kind that we saw marching yesterday, who have this hope of becoming journalists?
You know, I'm not going to get hung up on form. I'm not going to get hung up on form, because the form, again, has changed and morphed over the centuries that we've been telling stories. People need stories, and they know that they need stories. They used to need stories sitting around fires and telling them aloud. And then they needed stories by writing them down on clay tablets. And the forms have changed and morphed, and I think that will continue. So will we be getting more and more of our news online? Perhaps. Will there come a day when the great newspapers are basically online outlets and there isn't a paper version? That would break my heart, frankly,
as someone
who has gone to the press room and felt them come warm out of the machine. But what's important is that we tell the stories. What's important is that we dig for data and facts and the truth, and that the American people have access to that. And that's what's happening right now. And I have to believe that that's what's going to continue to happen.
I have to say, who saw The Post, the movie The Post? I cried when those papers came pounding off at the end. I actually cried.
So I went to a screening. A lot of The Post, if you haven't seen it, takes place actually at a paper called The Times, because The Post wound up publishing the Pentagon Papers after The Times was enjoined from continuing to publish them.
Right.
And I've grown up in the newspaper business. I started as a copy girl when I was 18 years old. And we were at a special screening, early screening of The Post, my husband and I was sitting there. And I think 10 minutes in, I started to cry, and I didn't stop during the rest, because it was like watching my life. And some of the people in it were people
you knew,
I knew very, very well. And it was a combination of watching my life, watching certain routines and forms that have ceased to exist. Typewriters, for example, watching those people and being so unbelievably proud to have been part of it. I am prouder of having been a newspaper reporter than of anything.
Yeah, it is amazing. New York City, I have to ask you, because we exchanged some Q&A things in email before this, and you talked about your overweening love of New York, and certainly New York is an important character in Alternate Side. What is it about this city that you said, when my ashes get scattered, it will be in the Hudson River? Tell me what it is about New York that grabbed you.
You know, it's almost like some weird thing being in sync. I feel like my metabolism and the city's metabolism are the same thing. That if you hooked both of us up to an EKG, you'd get the same wave pattern. It's invaluable for somebody whose stock and trade is understanding human beings.
Got lots of them to study.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I get a lot of work done during the summers when I live in our house in Pennsylvania, which is kind of in a semi-rural area. And you know, I walk around the pond in the morning and then I think, well, damn, I'm so bored, I guess I'll write something. and I do get a lot done, and there are many fewer distractions, but I couldn't live there full time because the amount of observation I can do of human beings is just, in the city, is just nonpareil. I just love it. I like kind of everything about it.
How have you evolved, do you think, as a storyteller? Since the first novel, so this is number 9.
I'm less afraid. Yeah. I mean, there are things that I do in this book and ways in which I tell the story and stylistic tropes that I was a more conventional novelist when I started. I was conventional in terms, not so much in terms of style, because my style, I mean, the writer's voice I have has been pretty consistent for a long period of time. But in terms of form, in terms of how the story unspooled. And as time went by, I got a little bit more away from that. And I felt most excited about it when I did Still Life with Breadcrumbs, because I did this kind of omniscient narrator that said and did things that I had never really thought you could have the narrator do. And suddenly I thought, well, I can do whatever I want. I guess it's that feeling. Yeah. I can do whatever I want. I can say whatever I want. There's a fearlessness that you develop over time. And not to put too fine a point on it, there's a fearlessness that you can develop if you found an audience. Mm-hmm. My books have found an audience, yeah. And that gives me that launch pad from which to have that kind of confidence.
Now, how do you and other writers view the National Writers Series, what we are doing right here, in terms of what it's doing to support books and support writers?
Oh, it's so great. I mean, look, most of the time we're in a little room by ourselves, writing and looking at this and thinking, is anybody reading this? It's as though you're having a conversation, but there's no one on the other end. Mm. And to be able to come out and have that conversation and understand that you were speaking with someone, that there really was someone on the other end of that phone, it's kind of thrilling. And honestly, you know, a night like tonight, when there's so many readers, when there's so many people who take the trouble to come out, you kind of live on that. I mean, it's so funny because I hope you won't be insulted, but the first time I came here, which was a number of years ago, I get this schedule and it says, okay, and now you're going to Traverse City, Michigan. And I went, where the hell is Traverse City, Michigan? And my publicist at Random House was like, you should go and do this. This is a really good event. You know, you'll do this on stage conversation. It'll really be great, and a lot of people come out. So I come, I do this, and then I go back, and I'm like an evangelist. And I'm talking to my friend Harlan Coben, and I go, dude, I'm going to tell them to invite you to Traverse City. And he goes,
I've already been to Traverse City. Isn't it the greatest? Didn't you have the best time there? And I get my friend Beth Macy on the phone, and I'm like, Beth, I'm going to tell them to ask you to come to Traverse City. And she goes, I've been to Traverse City. And I got snowed in for 2 days, and it was fantastic. So I think that all of us in this business treasure readers, and we treasure places that treasure writers. And this is near the top, near the top of the list.
Well, there we go. Anna, thank you so much.
That was Anna Quinlan talking with Cynthia Canty. Anna Quinlan's latest novel is Alternate Side. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.